But I want to tell you something. We had fun. I hope that last week, when we did not meet for our worship service, that you had a chance with your family or at home, either have private devotional time or maybe even with your family to do a little worship, whatever that might have looked like. One thing we did for our family is we tried to have a little family worship service, and my favorite part of the worship service was it had more to do with the preparation for us worshiping than actually what we did together, because all the kids were jockeying who got to be Becky Wellner and who got to be Rick Whitlock. And they were fighting over it. Miriam ran upstairs and got a drum set, and she sat down and she said, I don't know if I'm Rick or Chuck or John, or I don't know who I am, but I'm the drummer, is what she said. And Adelaide was all ready. She had a microphone, and we only had two microphones in the house, play microphones. And they were fighting over who got to be the singers. Sadly, no one wanted to be me. And they said I had to give the message. I had to give the sermon. Dana gave it, which was fantastic. But anyway, we had a wonderful time. It was shorter than the worship service we normally had. There were much more disruptions, but it was a sweet time for our family. But all that to say, I also really missed you. I said that in my email. It seems odd, but there is a benefit just to seeing other people, folks that sometimes we only get to see each other once a week. And for me as a pastor and just me as a worshiper alongside of you, it's just there's something sweet about this rhythm that we have every single Sunday. We get to gather together and to worship God. And it was really nice for me because I felt that. You know, when we're here every single Sunday, we kind of take it for granted. But there's a part of being here, being in worship and seeing familiar faces and chit-chatting that is sweet about what it means to be the people of God. And so if you haven't been in a regular rhythm in the past in worshiping, I encourage you to make that a goal, to make that a priority, so that you can experience that sweetness of the rhythm that God calls us to be people of worship each week. Let's begin by reading our passage in John. There's 2 weeks, really. Next week, we're going to begin a prayer series. You may have seen it on Facebook or have seen it in announcements of the church. We're going to begin a 7-week series called Too Busy Not to Pray. And the sermons will be on that series. We have small group curriculum that we're developing that will be on that series. We'll have daily devotions that will help us to develop our life of prayer. If you're not a part of a small group, we have special groups that will be forming up just for this 7 weeks. And inside your bulletin, there's a white tear-off sheet, and you can note that you're not in a small group, but you'd like to be a part of a group for just those 7 weeks. We'll make sure we find a group for you to meet with. But we want you to really take this series seriously. We want to grow in our ability to be praying people. But all that to say that we had this 2-week window in between Advent and then the beginning of that prayer series next week. And my goal was to go through the very beginning of John chapter 1, last week and this week. Well, I'm just combining them together. So this sermon will be an hour and a half. All right? No one's laughing. I like that. So instead, I'm just going to combine them together in our time. John 1, and we're going to read verses 1 through 18. It'll be on the screen if you'd want to follow along there too. It says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. There came a man who was sent from God. His name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all men might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only, who came from the Father full of grace and truth. John testifies concerning him. He cries out, saying, 'This was he of whom I said, He who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me. From the fullness of his grace, we have all received one blessing after another. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has seen God,
But God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known. Amen. So I understand there is a lot in that passage, and that it can be a little wordy as John goes through the gospel there and shares with us his version of the Christmas story. You'll notice in the Gospel of John, you don't get what we talked about in the Christmas story. You don't get Matthew, or you don't get Joseph and Mary and their trek and all that happened around Jesus' birth. This is how John tells about Jesus coming to us. If you remember, if you were here for Christmas Eve, and I know a lot of people are out of town for Christmas and other places, but if you're here for Christmas Eve, one of the things that I said as we talked about the Christmas story is the way that Jesus comes into the world, the manner, the events, the way that God initiates, the way that God puts on flesh in Jesus Christ in the world is just as important as the fact that Jesus came into the world. And so when we talked about that in Christmas Eve, we talked about the very events that Jesus came as a baby, that Jesus came into a family that did not have wealth, that Jesus came into a family that had no political position, and all those things around the Christmas story. The way that Jesus came into the world was just as important as the fact that he came into the world. I think we find a similar theme in John 1. That the way that God does things is just as important as the fact that he does them. We find this in our own lives, don't we? The way that we go about something is just as important as what we do or what we say. The way that I go and reconcile to a friend that I have conflict with, or the way that I go about reconciling to an enemy I have, is just as important as whether or not I say the words, "I'm sorry." We have ways of going through the motions. We have ways of even saying the right things. But in Jesus Christ, we find that everything, his will, his deeds, his words are perfectly integrated. He is full of integrity. He is one. I drew up a little diagram because that's what I do and how I think about these things. So this is what I would say the difference is between us and Jesus. In Jesus, his will, his heart, the very essence of his being is perfectly integrated with what he says and what he does. It all perfectly overlaps. When Jesus goes and he teaches about what it means to be forgiving, that is how he is. That is the very nature of his being. It is what his heart actually is experiencing. And so he speaks it and he does it. It all is perfectly integrated with one another. Yet you and I know that our lives are not that way. That we experience a tension between our hearts or our wills, what we want to do. You know, Paul in that famous passage talks about this. I know what I want to do. I can't do what I want to do. I try to do what I want to do, but then I don't do it, and it just kind of is all wrapped up together. So we have what we want to do, we have what we actually do, and then we have what we say. And maybe every once in a while in our lives there's this part where they do overlap and we find integrity. We hope that increasingly we do. But Jesus finds that perfectly in who he is. Perfectly in how he exists. In John chapter 1, the metaphor that the gospel writer uses, and it's important, this John that is writing this gospel is the John that is one of Jesus' 12 disciples. He is the John that at the cross, Jesus says, "You need to care for my mom Mary after I'm gone." He's the John that's on the inner circle of the 12 that is by Jesus' side. And so this John was right there in everything that Jesus does in his ministry over those 3 years leading up into his death. He's right there at the cross. And so he knows Jesus very well. The metaphor that John uses in his gospel in describing what it is that Jesus does is he describes Jesus as the light of the world. He describes the world as a place of darkness, and that Jesus, God himself, interjected himself into that dark world as the light that shines forth. And the thing that I want to talk about is that light that comes forward, the light that is Jesus, the light is that God in the world is both dangerous and glorious. It is dangerous because it points out the contradictions in us. It exposes us. It breaks us down. But it is also glorious because it brings us more and more in line with how Jesus interacted. It brings us more in line with who Jesus was. It brings us closer to what it means to have life and life to the full and forgiveness and newness. So how do we have this integrated life? So if we experience life as this contradiction between these three things, and we know what that's like in our life, how is it that we experience full integration? I think most of the time, the way that we think we experience it is by trying harder. Well, let me just push more. If I could only work harder to actually do what I want to do, we could get there. The Gospel of John helps us to understand that that is not how darkness is overcome. If you look at John chapter 1, we find a pretty simple progression. What's powerful about the Gospel of John is that it begins before Genesis 1, which I think is a lot of fun. So John 1, it says exactly how Genesis 1 begins. In the beginning. When people would have heard that, they would have heard in the beginning, oh, that sounds exactly like how the very first book of the Bible, Genesis, begins. In the beginning. But notice that John begins even before the creation of the earth and the heavens and the earth. He says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. So before the heavens and the earth are created, God exists. The Trinity exists. God Himself is one. The Word, as we'll go through John, we'll find this Word comes into physical existence through the human being of Jesus Christ. But even before the heavens and the earth were created, God and Jesus, God and the Word, God and the Spirit were one. And it's not until verse 3 in John 1 that we ever get to anything physical being created. Verse 3 says, through Him all things were made. A quick way of describing all that happens in Genesis 1. So the God that we're talking about that initiates in the being of Jesus Christ is the same God that breathed human beings into existence, the same God that created the heavens and the earth, the same God that created everything that we can see and touch and feel, all of His creation. That's the God that John is talking about. And so he goes on to say, through Him all things were made, that God. Without Him nothing that exists was made. And in Him was life, and that life was the light of men. That light was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. The darkness has not comprehended it. The darkness has not absorbed it. Now go back to the Genesis story. The Genesis story is that this God breathed into existence human beings. And those human beings in Genesis had a wonderful, harmonious existence with God. In a sense, they had the light of God. They were not in darkness, but were in light in their relationship with God. All was good. If you think about a metaphor of literally a candle of their life, that candle was lit by the very breath of God. That candle was lit by the relationship and the connection that they had with God. And yet what we find is the history of humanity is that our instinct, our will as people is to think, well, that light that I have that was lit by God is great, it's fine, but I think I could do something brighter and better on my own. It seems like, think about the Genesis story and the decision that Adam and Eve made to pursue their own path, believing that in some way God's light was holding back on them, that there was something that God wasn't telling them. There was something that they didn't have access to in what God had given them. And so the story of the fall is literally that they decided to do away with the light. They decided to extinguish the candle that was lit inside of them and to pursue their own light. We can think of all sorts of metaphors in our day. Maybe they thought they could create a floodlight on their own. Maybe they thought that they could create a flashlight that would never end and see all around. And so the history of humankind has been that we have been thinking and pursuing light on our own. We've been running around with flashlights or floodlights or whatever source of light you think you might be able to create by our own human power, and we have been trying to wade through the darkness of the world with that light. And so this is the picture that John paints for us, is that God breathed everything into existence. The pre-existence, all of it came in. And into that world, because of the fall of humanity, the folks that John is writing to then found themselves in darkness. All of us in our human condition found ourselves in darkness. But then verse 6 says, "There came a man who was sent from God. His name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light." That light that was now going to come again into the world. "So that through him all men might believe." John points out he himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. John the Baptist says that quite clearly. I'm not the one. I'm not the light coming into the world, but I'm telling you that that light is coming. "The true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him." John, wrapped up here in John 1, is talking about not just the Christmas story, but the whole identity of Jesus. On really two levels. The first one is that God in the Old Testament had literally carved out a people, the Israelites, and said that you will be my people. I will communicate to you directly through the prophets. I will share my will and my law with you. I will give you particular and special blessings because you are my people, and you will be witnesses to all the other nations that there is one true God. That God is Yahweh. And God specifically and specially called those people and told them of what his great work would be. And that in Jesus Christ, then God puts on flesh, and those very people, very few of them recognized that he was the same God that had called them and chosen them. At still a broader level is all of humanity, all of us, the God of the universe, the one that created us and breathed us into life, put on flesh, came into the neighborhood and hung out with us. And very few people recognized him. In the Christmas story, we understand why very few people recognized him, because it wasn't meeting their expectations. And they had all sorts of expectations. When the Messiah came, this is how he must look. If God is to come, won't he be floating on a cloud? Won't he have a halo around him? Won't he be glowing white? Won't he be a king? Won't he be royal? Won't he be rich? Won't he be powerful? And so when Jesus comes, it's no wonder that they thought, that can't be God. There's no way. And yet Jesus says that he is God. John affirms that in Jesus, the light of the world has come and put on flesh, though few will recognize him. 12, "Yet to all who do receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God." And then he says, "The word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." That indeed, in Jesus Christ, God came to us. So in this life, we have our wills and we have our deeds and we have our words, and you and I, in pursuing righteousness, want those things to be integrated. And so much of our wills call us, if we just work harder and we try harder and we just bear our knuckles down more fervently, maybe we can get there. And to that, John says that the only way there is to expose ourselves to the light that is Christ. You and I, when we look up into the nighttime sky, we see the moon. How does the moon appear to us? It appears to us as light, doesn't it? The moon produces no light. When we put men on the moon and they got to walk around on the moon, it was gray matter, basically. It's gray. It doesn't produce any light. The moon produces light to our eyes because the sun reflects off the moon, and that's what we see from Earth. You and I, as followers of Jesus Christ, our task is to reflect in our own lives the light that is God, the light that was revealed to us, that came to us through Jesus Christ. And to the extent that we reflect that light or we absorb it, to the extent that we are exposed to that light, we are exposed to the very power of God to transform us. We're exposed to the very power of God by leaning into God, by abiding in God, that has the ability to transform us from the inside out. Do you see the difference? If God, if Christ is the light, then our job is not to like scurry around all over the place, but our job is to just get closer and to lean and to expose literally our life to that light. To give God access to the darkest parts of us. I mean, think about that now. What are some dark places in your life right now? What are some dark places? What are some dark relationships? What are some sins that have been really hard and that you feel like you have never been able to overcome in your life? What are some frustrations that have persisted? What is dark in your life right now? The only way that light will come into that situation, the only way that hope enters in, the only hope for reconciliation is by us literally leaning into God. By us allowing the light of God, the light of Christ, to shine in on that. It's a really subtle difference. You know, I experienced in my life, and as we've started to prepare for this prayer service series, one of the things I've thought to myself is, you know, I talk to myself a lot about God, but I'm not so much actually talking with God. It seems kind of silly, but I experience that as a profound distinction in my life when I think about prayer, that I talk to myself a ton about other people and about relationships and even about theology and things I'm thinking about. But that is very different than what it means for me to talk with God about those things. For me to be exposed to God in conversation, to be exposed to the light. In those areas of darkness, are we finding that we're primarily talking to ourselves about what we think would be best to do? Or do we find that we are trying to listen, to hear, and to allow God to enter into that darkness? I think often we literally take a candle, the candle of our life, and we want there to be light there. And so we just grin and bear it and just try to like, come on, light up, catch on fire. And maybe if you had some resources, you could knock some rocks together or something like that to create a spark. But the God of the universe literally wants us to take the candle of our light and quit trying so hard and to expose it to the fire that is His Spirit, to the light that comes to us in Jesus Christ. Oops. Sorry about that. That was not a dramatic effect, I promise. Allow us to be exposed to that light that is Jesus. You know, this light comes to us in a choice. In Christianity, we call this faith. The choice of faith. The Bible talks about this. John talks about this a lot. That the light of God, the light of the world, has come into the world. But that light coming to us beckons a response. It calls us either to be exposed to that light, as John talks about here, to believe in it, to trust that in Jesus Christ God really has come to us, or to ignore it and to push it away. Later on in John chapter 3, John talks specifically about this. You know, the famous verse that we all have memorized, many of us have memorized at some point, is John 3:16. Right after that, John talks a lot about light and darkness. Verse 18, whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe stands condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of God's one and only Son. Then he says this, this is the verdict. Light has come into the world. He's saying the exact same thing he said in John 1. But men, people, loved darkness instead of light, because their deeds were evil. The reality is light has come into the world. And because light has come into the world, we have been given a choice. Will we embrace that light, or will we prefer, will we choose darkness over that light? It says, some have chosen darkness, loved darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Well, why was that a big deal? Well, everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. The light is dangerous and glorious. The glorious part we love, right? The light that could bring us new life. The light that could reconcile the broken relationships. The light that could make things in our lives that are broken, not broken anymore. That's light we get excited about. But what about that light being dangerous? What if when we want to expose our lives and that conflict and that darkness in our lives to that light, and instead of that light saying that our friend is the one that keeps screwing up and we need to be grace-filled to them, all of a sudden that light starts to show some things in us that are pretty gross. All of a sudden that light starts to expose us in ways that we're horribly uncomfortable with. All of a sudden that light starts to be extremely dangerous. And what John is saying is that some of us will just choose the darkness then. If light means that I have to acknowledge how broken my heart really is, if light means that God is going to open me up and dissect me and show me how prideful I am, if light is going to show me that that conflict I have has a lot less to do with those other people and a lot more to do with me, then the reality is that many people will choose darkness because darkness is safer. You know, some have said it makes sense for kids to be afraid of the dark, but it's a tragedy when adults are afraid of the light. Some of us are afraid of the light. If not in general, certainly in particular areas. We are not prepared to change. And the light of Christ comes to us regularly and powerfully as dangerous. And the only way that we will expose ourselves to a dangerous light is if we trust in the very nature and truth of God's character. Do we believe that the author of that light, the source of that light, is good, holy, perfect, knows us better than we know ourselves, created us into existence, knows what we need better than we think what we need is? If we can believe that, we will expose ourselves to a light that is dangerous, but also a light that is glorious. A light that takes us into places we cannot go on our own. A light that brings us into a place of integrity where we can find an overlapping of our will and our deeds and our words. love always prevails, that light always prevails over darkness. It's hard to come out of hiding, but when we do, it beckons us to truth. It beckons us to the true fulfillment that God calls us to. I want to end by a simple example. There's an author that many of you may have read in the past named Malcolm Gladwell. So I stuck it up here. He's written several books. Blink is an example of that. Outliers, some really great books. And I've always really enjoyed reading him. And one of the things that has happened recently is the last book that Malcolm Gladwell wrote was called David and Goliath, a new book that's coming out. It has actually already come out. And one of the things that's been interesting about his work in studying David and Goliath is that Malcolm, who had kind of come away from faith, he grew up in the church, but of his family, he was the one that walked away. He moved to the East Coast, and he just stopped any activity, really, in his local church at all. But in the process of writing this book, he has come back to faith. And so there was an article recently in Relevant Magazine about why that was. And Malcolm Gladwell, actually, he wrote it himself, and he talked about this process. And it really is about seeing the light of the living and powerful God reflected in other people that drew him back to understanding that the God that we are called to worship is a God of power, a God that does things in this world that are extraordinary, that are dangerous, but also full of glory, that are radically different than the darkness of this world. And so I just want to read the beginning of this and tell you a little about the story. The beginning of the article says this: when I was writing my book, David and Goliath, I went to see a woman in Winnipeg by the name of Wilma Dirksen. 30 years before, her teenage daughter, Candace, had disappeared on her way home from school. The city had launched the largest manhunt in its history, and after a week, Candace's body was found in a hut a quarter of a mile from the Dirksen's house. Her hands and feet had been bound. Wilma and her husband Cliff were called into the local police station and told the news. Candace's funeral was the next day, followed by a news conference. Virtually every news outlet in the province was there because Candace's disappearance had gripped the city. "How do you feel about whoever did this to Candace?" a reporter asked the Dirksens. "We would like to know who the person or persons are so we could share, hopefully, a love that seems to be missing in these people's lives," Cliff said. Wilma went next. "Our main concern was to find Candace. We found her," she went on. "I can't say at this point I forgive this person, but the stress was on the phrase 'at this point.' We have all done something dreadful in our lives or have felt the urge to," Malcolm says. And so he goes on to write about how part of the fundamental thing in transforming his faith was his interactions with this family whose daughter had been killed, who unbelievably and entirely unexplainably desired more than anything to, one, find their daughter, but two, to get to a place where they could forgive the person that did it. And notice what he finds remarkable isn't that they said, "We've forgiven him, everything's fine," but that they even had the desire to forgive. Unexplainable to the world. And he goes on to say, as he interacted with these folks, there was nothing remarkable about them from a worldly standpoint. They weren't rich. They didn't walk around in robes of some powerful, holy presence that they gave forth. They seemed like very ordinary, simple people. They worshiped in a Mennonite church, in a Mennonite tradition that came from all sorts of persecution in Europe and beyond. A church that taught, when folks persecute you, you cannot fight darkness with darkness, but it is only light that can ever shine new life into darkness. People that believed in Jesus Christ being the light of the world, God putting on flesh, that believed that that light could change anything, even the guy that killed their daughter. And so Malcolm goes forth to study David and Goliath and why people thought Goliath was powerful and what it was in David. And he arrives at this deep sense that the power of God is real. And not because of some radical miracle, but because of the power of God he saw in the lives of average people that did extraordinary things because their life was reflecting the light of Christ. You and I believe that the God of the universe has put on flesh, that God himself has entered into our neighborhood in Jesus Christ, that Jesus Christ is the light of the world, and that some people recognize that light and others don't. You and I need to expose our life fully to that dangerous and glorious light, and we need to reflect him in all its fullness to those in our family and to our neighborhood and to this community. You know where darkness lies in your life. I don't. You know what areas of your life need to be exposed to that light. May we be people that are exposed to the light of God, the light of Christ. Let's pray together.